My name's Frank. I'm an alcoholic, happy alcoholic. And it's nice to be in your company. I really have felt an enormous amount of concentration of what AA is about since I arrived here yesterday. I arrived here in time for the discussion meeting yesterday, and I heard Tom last night, and look forward to Sandy today, and June. Powerful talk about what AA is about, reconciliation with ourselves and with God and the community around us. I hope you noticed I smiled while I was waiting to be introduced. Some of you may have noticed that. Because someone said, "My God, you're so intense. You look like you're going to a hanging." You know, so I try to break that a little bit. I take myself very seriously. You know, everything I do is intense. You know, I tell you to lighten up, but I meanwhile get more intense. I want to thank my host, Ron, and his wife, Joni, for looking after me. They've been incredibly good. I had a tour of Atlanta. I've been to Atlanta a number of times before, but you know, you're rushed to a hotel, and then you're rushed back to the airport on Sunday, so you never really get a look at the town. I am a people watcher. I love to watch people, and I had a chance to do that in downtown Atlanta yesterday as we in a ride with a BMW, too. So anyway, I'm very happy. I want you to know I feel very passionate about my talk. Someone said, you know, a fanatic is somebody who can't change the subject and or can't change his mind and won't change the subject, you know, and that fits me, you know, when I get on stuff. I think, by the way, no saving seats here. I want you to know that the committee has decided there'll be no saving seats for this little tradition talk. By the way, often you never hear about the traditions until somebody says something like, "Gloria's breaking the sixth tradition," and everybody looks at the window shade to see what crime Gloria's committing, you know, and then we sink back into unconsciousness. And I'm glad they read the traditions first at the beginning, because the miracle is we've been around for 63 years. For 63 years. I muse with where I would have been had there not been an Alcoholics Anonymous. I was 36 years old. I came in, I do have a sobriety date, although it doesn't look or sound like it, probably. June 10th, 1970, and I never wanted to change it when I heard that was Dr. Bob's anniversary and our own collective anniversary too. And I came in, June is the best month to come to AA. You stick to those chairs in June and July, August. It's hard to leave with a chair stuck to you and not be noticed, you know, if you're a people pleaser. And I've just stuck to AA all these years. Fascinated with every year that goes by. And I've been blessed to be in an environment during most of that time where I get massive amounts of Alcoholics Anonymous, the program and the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. I like to remind myself, I didn't stay drunk on marginal amounts of drinking. I had to have vast amounts of drinking to stay drunk. And I need vast amounts of a spiritual program to stay happy, comfortable, and useful. And joyously we have it. You know, we don't have to wait a week to go by. I didn't drink once a week, you know, for an hour. I drink all the time. I couldn't leave this drinking experience to go to another without a little traveler, you know. Otherwise, I'd stay where I was. Kitchens are holy places for me. I would be in your kitchen at 2 and 3 in the morning. You know, often the others would go to bed, whoseever house it was, but I'd be there in the kitchen full of talk, you know, wanting to settle this. One more drink and we could wrap it up. Remember the clarity we had access to at those hours. We could really fix things if we just stayed here another few minutes. And I never felt that passion and intensity and clarity in American industry the next morning. You know, I just, oh, God, they want you to work and do these papers. Anyway, I've been blessed to have been in your company for a long, long time. And also I've worked at the General Service Office for 21 years, so I had lots of contact with you guys. And I've been in the historical portion of the General Service Office, so I know you all want to know your group's history and who's the oldest member in Lincoln, Nebraska, Is it Gloria or Fred? You know, that kind of stuff. That's what we want to know about history. I think it's very important that we own our collective history. I think it's very important that I own my own history. And as our speaker last night pointed out, and June this afternoon, or this morning, otherwise I'm going to get in trouble. You know, if I forget where I've come from, I'm going to be in big trouble. First emotionally, and then physically. You know, I would lose my gratitude, I would lose my perspective, I would be in big, big trouble. And I own my own story by listening to yours, by powerful identifications at many, 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 many AA meetings, that I'm not the only one. I always thought I was the only one. Isolation is my primary condition, and I treat emotional isolation. And I treated that with vast amounts of alcohol, you know, and it worked. I'm a very self-centered, very self-conscious person. I was paralyzed in school, school. I describe myself as somebody with a foot on the brake and the accelerator in the same moment. You know, I wanted to go for it, but I was afraid to move, make a mistake. And I was smart. I could finish their sentences before, you know, I could give them the answer to the question from my seat before they finished the question. You know, get the answer before they finished the question. If I had to stand up and recite, I fell apart. You know, I couldn't stand the thing I wanted most, attention. I was so self-conscious. And I treated self-consciousness with vast amounts of alcohol. And I became God-conscious. I became other-conscious when I drank enough. You know, I could get out of myself for micro-moments sometimes. But I could sing. I did Johnny Ray imitations and Frankie Lane imitations. I'm not going to do that this year. Don't get alarmed. I haven't done those sober. But I felt I could do all that stuff. And I think like every other alcoholic in the room, I did that as long as I could. I've never heard a story where anybody stops a half hour before we have to. Most of us, if you're like me, stopped a decade after we should have. We're the leftover ones. A lot of people think AA is about not drinking. If that were true, I would have hung myself if I thought AA was about not drinking. You know, AA to me is how do you live a life you never wanted to live? You know, I was enormously self-destructive. I would push anybody who was trying to help me away, and both drinking and at the end of my drinking and even before. I always would rivet on what I didn't have. You know, my nature is to find out what's wrong with this picture. And that's what I tried to treat with alcohol. I come from a family. I felt they were crushed by life. And I didn't want to be like them. I was born in a mental hospital. My mother, manic depressive. And interestingly enough, that's what I induced with alcohol. If you're an alcoholic and you drink, you become what you hate the most. I was always afraid I was crazy, you know. Bad blood, it was called in those days. I was watched, and I watched back, and I was very careful, and I induced insanity with alcohol. If you're an alcoholic and you drink, you become what you hate the most. I was always fastidious. I always worried about packaging. I always knew how to camouflage myself. I always knew how to present myself. You know, I knew how to look attentive. I went to Catholic schools, and I could look devout. I just never felt anything. I just never could be devout, you know. And it's a hard way to live, you know. I was alive at the end of that. And in a lot of ways, recovery, I always remind myself, I didn't need Alcoholics Anonymous to survive alcoholism. That was a gift of God. I happened to be alive at the end of my drinking. You know, a friend of mine says, every alcoholic stops drinking. It's nice to be alive when you stop, you know. I was a drunken driver. You couldn't take the car keys away. I was determined to eradicate my life and yours if you were around me. And yet I was alive at the end of my drinking. AA to me is, what do you do with a life you never wanted to live? You know, how do you start all over at 36 years old and get a value system, something you can believe in, and begin to communicate with people you've always been terrified of? I didn't know that until I'd been sober for a while. I was terrified of people, that I locked myself in a prison of non-communication. And that's what I need Alcoholics Anonymous for, you know. And that's why a meeting or two or clinical sobriety doesn't have any interest to me. You know, I'm not interested in just being clinically sober. I think it's the beginning. It's the admittance card to a fundamental change in your personality, which was necessary for me. But I always liked a person when I came in. He said, "Frank, you got to get the drinking out of the way, because you're going to need all your energy to reconstruct your personality and your psyche." And I sensed that. I got sober at the Mustard Seed in New York. By the way, my home group now is the Oxford group on West 84th Street. Have you been? We have 105 chairs and another 10 people stand usually. We have 3 dogs come and about 4 children. We have a little announcement we read about pets have to be, restrained, and the children too, or will be asked to leave. But anyway, it's that kind of community. I like what June said. A community of AA. We are people who normally would not mix. I look around a room like this size, and there's no computer in the world could have imagined us being here this afternoon with our histories. Probably no computer could imagine any of us surviving our behavioral patterns, you know. And yet to be assembled in Atlanta on a July afternoon. And that's what I think the celebration of Alcoholics Anonymous is about. I think every AA meeting is a celebration. I think every AA meeting is a prayer, you know, whether we're conscious of it or not. Every time we come to a meeting, we're saying we're not enough by ourselves, conscious or unconscious. And every AA meeting has been a meditation. I always felt safe in an AA meeting. I owed a lot of money when I came in AA, and I thought my creditors would never look for me in an AA meeting. You know, look for me a lot of other places, but not in an AA meeting. And so I felt safe. And for you to tell your story and for me to be anonymous, that's a very healing thing. All of our principles are about healing. You know, about creating an environment for healing. You know, and my own history asserts to my own miracle, and our collective history asserts to our collective miracle. For alcoholics to be assembled for 63 years and sober has never happened before in the history of the world, to my knowledge. And alcoholics have been bothering people for a long time. I'm going to confusing ourselves and the others. I'll call them the others. I'm going to read a couple of things. By the way, you know, we have in our books and things a circle and a triangle. You know, by the way, AA comes of age, I never leave home without one. You know, if you're ever asked to lead a tradition meeting, all the historical background, you know, all of our stuff comes from pain and suffering and doing it wrong. I've always liked that about Alcoholics Anonymous. All of us learn lessons by doing it wrong. You know, I like that Marcel Proust said, wisdom doesn't come, we don't receive wisdom. It is earned as the result of a journey that nobody can take for us or spare us. Nobody can spare you your recovery. I always wanted to do everything fast, you know, avoid suffering at all costs. And what I really induced was I grabbed a personality that would assure that I suffered everything, you know, by trying to avoid the natural things of life. I so created a barrier to life that I suffered all the time from being alone and different and, you know, special. The rules of life didn't apply to me. I would tell you, don't drink and drive, as I grabbed the car keys and went off, you know, with one eye, you know, all that stuff. Protected by an ego, you know, that the rules didn't apply to me. And the circle and triangle is our signature, you know. And I'm told by engineers that the triangle is the strongest structure in geometry. I think it's very fitting that we have a triangle in our history. The base of the triangle, of course, is recovery. If you don't have your own recovery, you're not going very far. And you don't have a message. You know, our purpose is to carry a message. And if we don't have our own recovery, if we don't have our own magic, if we don't have our own miracle, we're not going to go very far. So of course the base of it is step meetings, the beginning of owning who I was. I'd always disowned myself at an early level. You know, I kind of treated myself as my patient, you know, would talk about myself in the third person, you know, almost, and separated. It wasn't until I'd been sober for a while that I began to own myself with all my pimples, you know, and all my disguises, you know, and I got that from sitting in chairs and hot rooms a lot and hearing you go through those kinds of things. That opened my own vistas and my own imagination to seeing who I was and where I'd come from. And so I've been a meeting junkie from the beginning and a step meeting person. You know, I always love step meetings. I always yearn for principles in my life, even though I wasn't able to follow them or use them. But AA has a wonderful abundance of principles, and for me, a very easy way to present them, you know, through somebody else's experience that I can identify with. Anyway, I've been very blessed to have a lot of insights and reclaiming myself and my family and stuff that I'd been separated from most of my life. And the second part of our tradition is unity. We have to hold this thing together. You know, AA's, alcoholics don't stay sober by themselves. Statistically, you may have other experiences. You may know somebody sober 85 years who's never gone to a meeting and is happy and useful. But throughout history, alcoholics haven't been able to stay sober by themselves. And if you've been around AA long enough, you know that that what we have, our recovery, is very fragile. You know, that it would be spiritually arrogant for me to believe, because I've been sober some time, that I'm always going to be sober unless I'm careful. You know, this thing is fragile. And that's true for us collectively. It would be spiritually arrogant for us to believe that as a fellowship, because we've been around 63 years, we're always going to be around unless we're careful. This thing is fragile. I don't know if you have them here, but in New York we have group depression meetings, you know, where you can go on a sun-filled afternoon, you know, with your new shirt for the dance that night, and in 20 minutes there's no reason to go on, you know. We'll never be well. And nobody mentions, we live in the problem, and nobody mentions the solution. So you go into instant despair, if you're like me. All that brings, its own toxicology. You know, every alcoholic in the room knows what it is to be intoxicated with fear. You know, my whole life I was intoxicated by fear. And full with poisons. And fear says, no, don't do, don't risk, don't take whatever. And alcoholism for me said, yes, take the chance, take the risk, whatever. And as I say, I followed that ace as long as I could. I played that ace as long as I could. Anyway, one day it was over. I just couldn't do it anymore, and I found myself in those chairs. And in a program that had been around for a while and had a critical mass of sober people, and largely had created an environment for me to heal. AA is more than a fellowship. For me, it's an environment for healing. You know, it's an environment for emotional healing, spiritual healing, and physical healing. I really think that if you have a broken leg and go to meetings, you'll heal faster than people who don't go to meetings. You know, and that's been demonstrated. If you produce endorphins and all that stuff, you get over physical ailments as well as psychic and other kinds of ailments with rapidity than those who don't. Or otherwise, we wouldn't go to meetings. I mean, everybody in the room has experienced that, and that's what brings us, whether we're conscious of it or not. Something magic happens when we assemble. You know, there's a magnification of faith. There's a magnification of power. And I think we can call that God consciousness, that I get out of self-consciousness and into God consciousness, even if I don't want to give it that name, even if I have a lot of resistance to giving it that name. There's something else that happens, and I've felt it at this convention since I've been here. I have a bad Achilles heel, I was telling my friends, and I think I feel better already, and it's only Saturday. You know, AA it has been, I'm just going to start with, some of you, how many have heard my little death dance before? Nobody. Wow. Fresh blood. Oh, we'll do the long version. I'm a New Yorker. I'll do everything quick. As I say, alcoholics have been bothering people for a long time. This was written 800 years before Christ by Solomon. Pretty wise man, I'm told. I wasn't there. 3,000, I'm getting into it by hearsay. Pretty wise man, but almost 3,000 years ago, he wrote this. See if you identify any of the alcoholics in the room. Identify with that. Who hath woe? Who hath sorrow? Who hath contentions? Who hath babbling? Who hath wounds without cause? You remember? Who hath redness of eyes? You remember the black and blue marks? And you said, I thought I had a good time at the dance last night. And then he goes, who hath redness of eyes? They that tarry long at the wine, and they that go to seek mixed wine. Look not upon the wine when it is red, when it giveth itself in the color of the cup, when it moveth itself aright. At last it biteth like a serpent, and stingeth like an adder. See if you identify with any. Thine eyes shall behold strange women. Thine heart shall utter perverse things. Yea, thou shalt be as he that lieth down in the midst of the sea, or he that lieth on the top of the mast. They have stricken me, thou shalt say, and I was not sick. And they have beaten me, and I have felt it not. And here's the kicker. When shall I awake? I will seek it yet again. No matter what, that's Proverbs 24:29, for those of you who want to study that a little bit. But in the morning, they will seek it yet again. Every morning, I drank for 23 years, 13 of them on a daily basis. In 7 of those years, I had access to massive amounts of pills. I worked for pharmaceutical advertising agencies and the clients. And I took pills to medicate acute alcoholism. I didn't mind being a drunk. I just didn't want to look and act like one. I never minded whatever anything about me. It was what people saw. Everything was appearance. My own private humiliations were okay. It was my public humiliations. You know, shame is my most powerful emotion because pride is my biggest sin. You know, I couldn't bear being stupid, and that's what I induced in myself. You know, Freud wrote, a fear is a wish. And whatever you fear is what you're going to bring into your life. You know, and boy, that's what I did. You know, and that's why I need a program. Anyway, 3,000 years ago they knew about it. I mean, I was, you know, how whatever state I was in the morning, I would get a beer. I would say, I need a drink. You know, I thought beer, you were giving your liver rest anyway. I didn't think that was very serious, beer and wine. I thought they were in the food category. You know, that's it. Didn't have to be ashamed. It was the Scotch sours and the... martinis to me were an early night. I was a blackout drinker, and if I got into martinis, I was out of it, you know, very quickly. You know, I was in automatic, what I called automatic. I used to think they were rest periods. Blackouts were rest periods. That everyone was repeating themselves or acting stupid, and I just had a little rest period. Anyway, that's... So 3,000 years ago, they had lots of problems with alcoholics and noticed them. And I haven't found... we have a local archivist here, Nancy, and she may have other things and be able to explore these kinds of things more fully with you. But I'm just going to give you some of the things that have gotten my attention over the years. I haven't been able to find much until the beginning of this country. You know, our country has had a long history with alcoholism. You know, somebody said the Pilgrims got off at Plymouth Rock not because they wanted to live in Massachusetts, but because they ran out of booze, you know. And I identify with that. I went a lot of weird places I didn't expect to go because I needed a drink. I had run out of booze. But here's a medical journal article written by Benjamin Rush, a physician, Donald knows him, and an inquiry into the effects of ardent spirits upon the human body and mind. Benjamin Rush is one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, a very prominent American, and see if you can identify with this. He says, the effects of ardent spirits divide themselves into such which are of a prompt and such which are of a chronic nature. The former discover themselves in drunkenness, and the latter in a numerous train of diseases and vices of the human body of mind. I shall begin by briefly describing their prompt or immediate effects in a fit of drunkenness. This odious disease, now he's the 1700s here, he's talking about alcoholism a disease. And you know, this country went through a whole thing in 1956 when the American Medical Association finally called alcoholism a disease. So my point is, people can know things and forget them. So individually and collectively, this country forgot that alcoholism was identified as a disease in colonial times by a very prominent American. Well, he said, this odious disease, by that name it should be called, appears with more or less the following symptoms, and most commonly in order which I shall enumerate them. See if you identify with any of these. Unusual garrulity, we talk too much. Two is unusual silence. Three is a capriciousness and a disposition to quarrel. Not many of us identify with that. uncommon good humor and an insipid simpering or laugh. Profane swearing and cursing is number five. Here's a favorite. Six, a disclosure of their own or other people's secrets. Seven is a rude disposition to tell those persons in company whom they know their faults. Eight is certain immodest acts. I'm sorry to say that this sign of the first stage of drunkenness sometimes appears in women who, when sober, are uniformly remarkable for chaste and decent manners. This whole front row could fall in. Nine is a clipping of words. Ten, fighting, a black eye, a swelled nose, often mark this grade of drunkenness. 11, certain extravagant acts which indicate a temporary fit of madness. These are singing, hallooing, roaring, imitating the noises of brute animals, jumping, tearing off clothes, dancing naked, breaking glasses and china, and dashing other articles of household furniture upon the ground or floor. After a while, the paroxysm of drunkenness is completely formed. The face now becomes flushed. The eyes project. Al-Anon would know this better than some of us. I am always amazed at AA meetings, they ask the alcoholic to tell their story. You know, a neighbor looking through a curtain knows more specific details on our comings and goings while we're drunk. The paroxysm of drunkenness is completely formed. The face now becomes flushed, the eyes project and are somewhat watery, winking is less frequent than is natural, the under jaw is protruded, the head inclines a little to one shoulder, the jaw falls, belching and hiccuping take place. The limbs totter, the whole body staggers. The unfortunate subject of this history next falls on his seat. He looks around him with a vacant countenance and mutters inarticulate sounds to himself. He attempts to rise and walk. In this attempt, he falls on his side, from which he gradually turns upon his back. He now closes his eyes and falls into a profound sleep, frequently attended with snoring and profuse sweats, and sometimes with such a relaxation of the muscles which confine the bladder and the lower bowels as to produce a symptom which delicacy forbids me to mention. Sensitive man, Benjamin Rush. In this condition, he often lies for 10, 12, 24 hours to 3, 4, 5 days, the object of pity and disgust to his family and friends. His recovery from this fit of intoxication is marked with several peculiar appearances. He opens his eyes and closes them again. He gapes and stretches his limbs. He then coughs and pukes. His voice is hoarse. He rises with difficulty and staggers to a chair. His eyes resemble balls of fire. His hands tremble. He loathes the sight of food. And here's the kicker. He calls for a glass of spirits to compose his stomach. The hair of the dog. He knew about alcoholism. Now and then he emits a deep-fetched sigh or groan and a transient twinge of conscience, and more frequently he scolds, curses everything around him. In this state of languor and stupidity, he remains for 2, 3, 4, 5 days. before he is able to resume his former habits of business and conversation. You know, I didn't know any of this, you know, when I came in. And I thought I moved in a medically sophisticated environment with well-educated people, and I knew nothing about the progression of alcoholism. You know, I thought the people in the Bowery grew up there. I don't know what I thought. You know, never occurred to me that I was heading there quickly and with no stopping. This country, you know, they discovered rum. As you know, they found the molasses, I think, in Barbados or something, and started to manufacture rum in this country. And alcoholism was a big thing in colonial times. You know, people worked hard and suffered and drank hard. And the next thing I've been able to locate is something attuned to the Washingtonians. These are things nobody's ever heard of, except people who read AA Comes of Age or some other literature in the background of alcoholism. But at one time, you know, temperance was alive and well in this country. Enormously powerful force, the temperance movement, American temperance movement, was. They filled huge halls and stadiums and stuff, and had marches, parades all over. At one time, 25% of the people over the age of 15 in this country signed a temperance pledge. Isn't that astounding? Try to get 25% of the people to do anything in this country, vote even. You can't do it. And yet they felt enough of the curse of alcoholism to sign a pledge. There was six alcoholics met every night in a bar, Chase Tavern in Baltimore. And one night they got drunk every night, and one of them at one of their gatherings they elected one of their members to go down to a temperance meeting, and he went down and came back the next day and said we all should go back, and the six of them went to a temperance meeting, and they, at that moment, it was March of 1840, they stopped drinking. You can imagine how statistically impossible that almost would be, to get six alcoholics to stop drinking in one day. So God has offered us reasons before. You know, there's a collective something, you know, that I've forgotten what it's called, but people get the same thought at the same time and can do it. You know, and that could be a voice of God or a calling, vocation, whatever you want to call it. But anyway, these six guys went down and they stopped drinking, and they started something called the Washingtonians. They called themselves Washingtonians, named after the first president of this country because he was a symbol for freedom. They became very, very popular. They started in March of 1840. By Christmas time of 1840, they had 1,000 recovered sots in the Washingtonians. This kind of stuff makes you humble. You remember that it took us almost 4 years to get 100 people recovered in Alcoholics Anonymous. By the time they did the big book in 1939, we may have had 100. They may have been goosing up the number a little bit, too. There may have been 87, depending. And it's hard to count alcoholics, you know. They move around a lot and they don't cooperate. I always thought you should put little tags in their ears, you know, like they do with geese, and follow them around and find out their patterns and where they cluster and that kind of stuff. Study us so that we could do detailed reports on the migration habits and of alcoholics. But anyway, they had 1,000 members before the end of their first year. By December. Abraham Lincoln spoke to them on their second anniversary. They, depending on what newspaper you read, they had from 100 to 300 recovered sots in the Washingtonians within 5 to 6 years. Within 8 years, it was written about them, they had lost their thunder. By 10 years, it was over. There were a couple of Washingtonian hospitals around. They had hospitals they had for, there's one in Boston, there may be others that I don't recall. By the way, I have memory problems, so I don't recall everything. At one time I almost did, so you'd be here late. But fortunately don't remember things, but they had a chain of hospitals. They had marches. They had and they had a lot of things we had. Weekly meetings that you brought people to meetings. They were very evangelistic to bringing other sots to the. But they didn't have our traditions. They couldn't stay together. Some of them became prominent speakers. They were featured by temperance causes, which were church-related, and they began to quarrel with themselves publicly, and in 8 years they had lost their thunder. And who ever heard of the Washingtonians today, except people have read kind of AA Comes of Age or other historical facts on alcoholism in this country. I often wonder what happened to those people that had been sober for a while. They got the thrill and the magic and passion of being sober, and then there was no place for them to go, you know, to retain that magic. You know, we don't stay sober and happy on one meeting or 1 year's worth of meeting. I mean, that's not my experience. I have to be replenished. My zeal and passion and encouragement has to be replenished on a regular basis, like I did with drinking. Another thing happened, and so they were gone. I think I mentioned the numbers of them. You know, depending on what you read, 100,000 to 300,000. There were 20 million people in the country at that time. AA would have to have 10 million in this country alone to have the same ratio. So, I mean, they took off like gangbusters. And in 8 years, they'd lost their passion. It makes you humble. You know, we've had a slow growth. You used to hear that when I came in to AA. I hope you have a slow recovery. Because you have time to make roots. You have time to anchor yourself. When emotional crises happen, you're anchored. You have friends. You have people to call. You hopefully have a sponsor and a home group. You can go and be wounded in your home group and heal. But if you're a fast study, you don't have those kinds of connections, and you're just engulfed with the terror of the problem or whatever. And then, you know, horses will run into the fire. Well-bred horses will run into the fire. They find it hard to save horses, racing horses, in fires because they'll run into the fire. They panic. And I believe that's true for this neurotic, this alcoholic. When I'm in a panic situation, when I'm engulfed with my negative emotions, I'll run into more anxiety, anxiety-producing behavior. You know, somebody said we run faster when we lost our way. And I think that's very true. And what meetings do are anchor us, give us some quiet time to reflect and relax a little bit and see opportunities for change and reconciliation with ourselves and the world around us. Anyway, along about the turn of the century, about 1906, there was something called the Emmanuel Group. You know, psychiatry was coming along in Europe. You know, the churches were powerful still, but people began to go to Europe and get doctorates in psychology. You know, they were fascinated with people's behavior. And one of the people who went over there and studied in Austria under a famous, whose name escapes me, it begins with an F, Fletcher or something, psychologist, was a man called Elwood Wooster. He was an Episcopal clergyman from Boston, the Emmanuel Episcopal Church in Boston. And he was fascinated with him. And he thought if you could combine the power of psychology with the power of religion, those two forces, you could really help people out of all kinds of distresses. And he was to start something called the Emmanuel Movement. And they singled out people with nervous disorders. And it won't surprise you, but they found out that most of the people, or many of the people with nervous disorders, were alcoholic. And they began to have successes with alcoholics. People had been sober for... You had to volunteer to go. Nobody could make you go or press you to go. You had to voluntarily go, and you had to abstain from alcohol. That was the agreement before you could enter the Emmanuel Movement, and they were very, very successful. He got a man called Courtney Baylor, sober and alcoholic, and they hired him. He became the first alcoholic counselor, Courtney Baylor. And they hired him to work with others. And they became very, very successful. And a number of people got sober. One man called Richard Peabody. We're going to see a little slide thing, so hold on here. Richard Peabody wrote a book. He was a recovered alcoholic from a very famous family, a shipping family in New England, who had lost all his money in despair. He got connected with the Emmanuel groups and got sober. And he lived, you're getting close to a connection with our own history. He lived in Gramercy Park, right near Sam Shoemaker. And a lot of alcoholics began to get sober. He made himself a counselor. He charged $20, which was a lot, an hour, to get counseling, a lot in the early 30s, late 20s, early 30s. And he began to counsel alcoholics. And he wrote a book, The Common Sense of Drinking. Kind of a contradiction, interesting title for us anyway. And it was a bestseller, sold in the millions. Bill had a copy when he got sober, and trying to understand the content of that. And but sadly, Richard Peabody was to drink again and die drunk. So we can know the answer and lose it. He didn't have a program. You know, he had set himself up as a specialist, getting $20 an hour, and he lost his way. You know, he was very good at telling other people what they had to do, but he couldn't do it himself. And so we learn another thing, that we can't be professional in AA. All of us are just a drink away from disaster. We're all vulnerable. And anyway, you see why we're learning a little of our traditions, our background. And the traditions were initially called the 12 principles to assure our future, to assure the future of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you could see that we learned a lot about the examples, the horrible examples of others. Somebody at the meeting yesterday said that he often was a good, bad example. You know, and these people were good, bad examples for us to apply. But anyway, the next thing that was to happen was something called the Oxford Groups. Our immediate ancestor was the Oxford Groups. This was man Frank Bookman. He had a violent encounter with the trustees of the board that he worked with young children in young men in Philadelphia, and he had a violent argument with them, and in rage he resigned and he went to England, and he had a conversion experience in England. He was just found himself in this church, and he heard a woman pastor talk about reconciliation and making amends and all that stuff, all that good stuff that we know about. And he went back to Philadelphia and made his amends and changed. And he started something called the Oxford Group. It got its name because it was very, very successful with Oxford University students. And it was a way to how to transform your life on a very basic level. They had spiritual principles. All of our steps, the principles of our step, as Bill reports, come directly from the Oxford Groups. Lots of alcoholics got sober in the Oxford Groups. And including Bill and Dr. Bob, you know, our ancestors. Dr. Bob, for example, attended Oxford Group meetings for 2.5 years before he met Bill. Bill attended Oxford Group meetings for 6 months before they all met, before he met Dr. Bob. So here we have, you know, these two alcoholics, one in New York, a lawyer who wasn't lawing. You know, he was trying to hustle people with stocks. And we have a drunken proctologist in Akron, Ohio. That's a thought you don't want to linger on, you know. So here are these two molecules, you know, half a country apart. Statistically, their chances of coming together are what? Nothing. Bill got a chance of a possible job with a company that they were redoing in Akron, Ohio, and it didn't go well for him. Didn't look like he was going to get the job, and he was staying at the Mayflower Hotel. Many of you know our bedtime story. From the church directory, the bar was making noise down one end. He was only sober 6 months. He had worked with other alcoholics in the Oxford groups, but none seemed to get sober or stay sober. And he called from the church directory, got the name Walter Tunks, an appealing name to him. Tunks didn't know any alcoholics, but he gave him in touch with Henrietta Seibeling at her gatehouse on Mother's Day, 1935. He met Dr. Bob and Anne, and they had attended with her Oxford group meetings with Henrietta, he agreed to come. As you remember, he was only going to stay for 5 minutes, and he stayed 5 hours. He drank again after that encounter, but on June 10th he had his last drink. And here's an interesting thing. Bill stayed in Akron with Dr. Bob in his house for 91 days. You know, what kind of commitment are we able to make with a newcomer? You know, don't drink and go to meetings, you know, and hand them a meeting book and we're out of there. But here one alcoholic lived with another, and that's the kind of thing that June was talking about, the community, the powerful community that we have, the village of Alcoholics Anonymous that we have available to us, that we can live in this kind of concentration of thing. Anyway, Dr. Bob began to get sober, and they began to carry the message to other people. And as you know, they got the third man, the man on the bed, Bill D., the lawyer, and he got sober. And then Bill went back to New York, and he began to get sober. The man who had carried the message to Bill, you remember, was Ebby, a friend of his from Vermont, but Ebby didn't stay sober himself. He had the passion to carry the message, but he couldn't apply. And he had intermittent sobriety during his life. I think he was sober at the end for about 2.5 years before he died. But at one time he had 8 years. He lived in Texas in community of AA, powerful community in AA in Texas, and I think he was sober 8 years. But I mean, there's a lot of humility in learning our history. You know, there's a lot of humility. Something that can break my ego, my attitude, is hearing my own story and seeing the hand of God. God has done for me what I could never have done for myself. You know, I'm doing this, and meanwhile God's doing that. And the same for us as collectively. You know, when we're planning these kinds of wonders, God has gotten two people sober. You know, statistically impossible for that to happen and stay sober. Neither one of our co-founders drank again. You know, it's a miracle. And not only that, you know, AA now is in 140 countries. You know, our big book, which they had to argue and fight, you all know the history of AA, that they had a quarrel with what kind of book was it going to be, and who was going to own it, and all those kinds of things. I'm going to show you some slides there in a minute. They had all those kinds of quarrels, and now our big book, I think, is in 40 languages or 42 languages. We're in 140 countries. You know, AA works. We don't have to demonstrate the fact that Alcoholics Anonymous works. You know, we've got our lives that speaks to the effectiveness of Alcoholics Anonymous. The thing we have to demonstrate to the world is that we can stay around. We can get along with ourselves for another 63 years. And that's the hard thing. You know, we are people who normally do not mix. And we need our traditions to keep emotional sobriety in our rooms. You know, how do we create an environment for healing in our rooms? And we've been given. Bill sensed this in the 40s. You know, AA was undergoing enormous growth. You know, you remember the Saturday Evening Post in March of 1941. There were 2,000 members in 1941. That's 6 years after AA started, almost. We only had 2,000 members. In 1 year after that Saturday Evening Post article, we had 8,000 members. One article, Saturday Evening Post, a lot of you young people never even heard of it, probably yourself, but it used to be in every doctor's office, in every barber shop. You know, it was everybody read the Saturday Evening Post. And we had 8,000 members in 1 year. And that's when they decided they needed a general service office to handle the correspondence, to help groups get started all over the U.S. and Canada. And now there's almost no place in AA, or no place in the country that you can't go to an AA meeting. You know, we're almost as available as Starbucks. You know, I don't know if that's happened here. I know I've been over to your one here across the thing, but all down Columbus Avenue, my street where I live near, we're all Starbucks coffee, so they must know that bars are on the way out with the growth of AA. We better get in this coffee business. But I'm just going to read something, a couple of things to you that I think are relevant, and then we're going to get into the traditions. Bill wrote, you know, as I say, success can be more corrosive to alcoholics than failure. I know that's true for me. When I lose something, I might get quiet. I might ask for help. And if I'm hurting enough, I might even take the help. But if I'm winning at life, who's going to tell me anything? You know, where do you live? How much money do you earn? You know, why are you dressed like that? And you're telling me something? You know, all the racket comes up, what I call the racket, to keep people away. You know, using the wrong word or something to upset me. You know, I don't like their tone, you know, so I can dismiss everything they're going to say. Or, you know, look, they've got brown socks on and black shoes, you know, something important to dismiss any advice they might give. You can't do that in AA because people don't have shoes or wear them, and often no socks. Look, we're a mess. Anyway, it's hard to have those things in AA, those things to keep people off. And that's true for organizations, too. We can be intoxicated with the size of AA. You know, we can consider ourselves so powerful that we can make people do things for us. We can fill stadiums, 50,000 people, San Diego. That's intoxicating. You can lose your humility. You know, forget that we're very fragile and we need each other and we need God in our life. We didn't do this ourselves. You know, we did this in spite of ourselves. And that's the consciousness we have to stay in. And joyously, we can do that at our meetings and participation. You know, the third part of the triangle is service. You know, you can really own your own recovery by giving it away. You know, I hear myself tell the people I sponsor things I should be hearing. And sometimes I can hear it, you know, and do it. Say a prayer or something. I found $1.02 this morning walking back from Starbucks. I first found a penny, and I thank God. The penny was tail up, which I don't really like them as much as heads up. But I thank God for that. And right next to it, a couple of inches away, was another penny. And I thank God. And that was heads up. I thank God for that. I was walking in the door to the hotel, the back, and there was a dollar. And I thought, seemingly gratitude for being happy with the penny, even though it wasn't my choice of a penny, you know, the wrong side, but it led to another penny, which led to a dollar. You know, when I was drunk, I never saw those messages, you know, let alone relate them to myself, that small amounts of gratitude produce enormous positive results if we're aware. Alcoholics Anonymous is about being aware, living your life fully to the max. You know, most of the time, sadly, in my life, I was unconscious. Either I was emotionally paralyzed, drunk by fear, or I was actually intoxicated by inducing vast quantities of alcohol into my system to be unconscious. You know, and AA is about elevating your consciousness. And that's why I say I didn't need Alcoholics Anonymous to survive my alcoholism. That was a gift of God. I needed AA to survive elevated consciousness. You know, when you can see yourself doing stupid things to yourself and other people you love, moving away from people you yearn to be with, saying no when you mean yes. That's what I need, AA, to raise my consciousness. And I need an environment to do that. That's the circle that engulfs the triangle, the fellowship. Bill says, implicit throughout AA's tradition is the confession that our fellowship has its sins. Isn't it a relief to know that I have character defects personally and our fellowship has its sins? We have a lot of service people in this room today. People that have dedicated a big chunk of their lives to serving Alcoholics Anonymous. I get a chill when I think that. I look around and see faces of people that have given their energies and passions to keep this thing whole and together and to create the environment for all of our healing. We confess that we have character defects as a society and that these defects threaten us continually. Our traditions are a guide to better ways of working and living, and they are also also an antidote to our various maladies. The 12 traditions are to group survival and harmony what AA's 12 steps are to each member's sobriety and peace of mind. You know, one of the people that have come, non-alcoholics have come to bless our fellowship has been Bernard Smith. He was the chairman of the board, non-alcoholic chairman of the board. And I'm going to he says, I frequently attempted to define the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous with little success, until one day in England I listened to a broadcast delivered by Canon Raven, a noted British religious leader. In the course of this broadcast, Canon Raven sent forth the conditions of a true fellowship in these words. Three conditions are necessary for true fellowship: the passion of a common ideal involving a complete release from selfishness and division. The discharge of a common task big enough to capture the imagination and give expression to loyalty. And the comradeship, the togetherness thus involved as we find out the joy and power of belonging to an organic society and engaging in whole-time service. We can find it at its fullest extent where the ideal is the highest and most exacting, where the task extends and integrates every ounce of our strength and every element of our being, where the comradeship is so solid and deep that we respond to one another without conscious effort, realize the unspoken need, and react to it spontaneously and at once. Under such conditions, all the vitality that we usually waste upon our jealousies and vanities, upon keeping up appearances and putting other people in their proper place, become available for creative use. Wow. You know, I've never been more creative in my life than at an AA meeting. You know, I have access to an imagination that I drank to try to get to. You know, that we're going to be safe, that there is a pattern and a method to life, that we are useful, you know, that there is those kinds of things in our life. Okay, you've been very attentive. I'm going to show some slides here of our history, my baby pictures mostly, me and the pram. I know that'll keep you riveted. You won't want to get up and miss any of them. Anyway, so we've been around 63 years, and if we're smart, we're going to be around a little more. I just want to, before I start the slides, I may have lost it, but anyway, you missed something good. I might find it by the time I do this. Oh, here it is. Some of you are too young to know Miss Abby, but I always like this, how AA has changed. You know, the thing about, you know, success has changed Alcoholics Anonymous. This was a Dear Abby letter that somebody had sent in, I think, to one of the bulletins, one of the Alcoholics Anonymous state bulletins. I'm a sailor in the U.S. Navy, and I have a cousin who belongs to Alcoholics Anonymous. My father has epilepsy, and my mother has syphilis, so neither of them work. They are totally dependent on my two sisters, who are prostitutes in Louisville, because my only brother is serving a life term in prison for rape and murder. I'm in love with a streetwalker who operates near our base. She knows nothing of my background, but she says she loves me. We intend to get married as soon as she settles her bigamy case, which is now in court. When I get out of the Navy, we intend to move to Detroit and open a small house. My problem is this. In view of the fact that I intend to make this girl my wife and bring her into my family, should I or should I not tell her about my cousin who's an AA?